Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us for our latest Employment 101 session. I think, well, it's fair to say we're through the summer period, right, Adrienne? Though you are bathed in
Yes,
sunshine.
I am bathed in sunshine, but I think I might put my blind down because otherwise I am going to be blinded. That's if I can actually work out how, but
Yeah,
yes.
no, you crack on. I'll just welcome everybody today. We're going to be back into our two-weekly cycle on this Employment Law 101. For those of you that don't know us, my name's Peter. I'm partner with NPM Legal. We are a specialist employment and business immigration practice. We're based in the south of England. We work with businesses that are all over the world and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. And that's where we help them out. Delighted as ever to be joined by Adrienne. Morning, Adrienne.
Morning. Apologies for me sounding incredibly snotty. I have got the typical back to school cold, well, I think is probably shooting around. So yeah, my dulcet tones are not so dulcet.
I know you're a little bit under the weather this morning. So yeah, thanks for still persevering and joining. Just a couple of housekeeping points. As always, this session's been recorded, so you can catch our recordings on Spotify, Amazon Music, where our podcast is. Our video recordings are on our website, NPM Legal, if you want to actually see us in person as well while we're delivering these sessions. There's a chat function down at the bottom if you want to chat to other participants that are online joining us live today. Obviously, the benefit for joining live, you get to ask us questions. And if you want to do that, just use the Q&A function down at the bottom because it just helps us manage those questions and respond to them in real time. So fire away with any questions you've got related to this topic today. What are we looking at today? Well, it's going to be just a discussion really on employment contracts. And hopefully today we can leave you just with a little bit of food for thought on what you're going to do next time you're reviewing your employment contracts and what sort of changes you might want to make. Now, the reason we thought we'd run this session today is that we are seeing more and more clients who are really conscious of how their offer letters and employment contracts feed into the whole onboarding process. And that's from a company culture perspective. As you can imagine, in this job that we do, we see a heck of a lot of different employment contracts, but in the main, they do tend to be quite heavy, legalistic, weighty documents. And certainly whilst some super detailed documents with lots of that legalese in there have a time and have a place, quite often they're not very reflective of a company's outlook or approach. Isn't that right, Adrienne?
Yeah, I mean, this is where Peter and I probably have a little bit of a difference of opinion, because I mean, I love plain English. Absolutely love plain English. I can't bear the heretofores and wherefore art thous and all that kind of stuff that you see. But I'm a big fan of clause numbers. But in any event, I think it's it's worthwhile remembering that as a very high level reminder, there's some essential ingredients that have to go in, and that's set out in law. But remembering that a contract has got to meet the typical terms for a binding contract. So you've got to have an intention to create legal relations. You've got to have offer, you've got to have acceptance, and you've got to have consideration, which is, you know, the payment or some benefit in exchange for for the parties to enter into the contract. And you've got to have certainty. Now, there are also obviously the Section 1 Employment Rights Act terms, which says, you know, this is everything that you've got to have in there. You know, it's important to make sure that you don't fall foul of that, because, you know, if an employee brings a claim to a tribunal, they can add that on as an additional claim. But there's a number of things that don't always have to go into the contract. But the basics: name of employer, employee, your start date, date of continuous employment, which is something actually that is sometimes missed when people do a refresh of the contract, salary, hours of work, and various other bits and pieces. There's also sort of technical rules around the timing of provision of Section 1 information, which is the basics that form the contract. Some information has to be provided via another document. Some information has to be provided within 2 months. But, you know, that other than the basics, you know, it's kind of up to you, isn't it, Peter?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the world's your oyster, really, in terms of other content that you want to put in, and you can make them as light or as heavy as you wish. I mean, bearing in mind, there isn't a legal requirement for a written employment contract, is there? So obviously we're always going to
recommend, other than your statement, Section 1 statement,
Section
terms.
1 statement. So you can provide your Section 1 statement and comply with what the Employment Rights Act says. Obviously, most employers will satisfy that requirement by including that information within a written employment contract. but there is no requirement to have a written employment contract as such. Of course, we're going to say, as lawyers, you absolutely should always have a written employment contract because it helps you out, right? It really closes down the scope for disagreement in the future over what the contractual terms that you've agreed between you are. And, common disputes in that area could be around bonus entitlement. So you can have separate bonus plans, of course. Like Adrienne, you've mentioned start dates, when employment actually commenced. That could be relevant for calculating statutory redundancy payments. What the applicable notice period is, that's quite a common one, isn't it? What's my notice entitlement as an employee? What notice am I due from my employer? So there are a whole myriad of reasons about why it's sensible to get that stuff down in writing. What I wanted to talk about and run through is just a few things that we've seen work really well and some things to avoid as well. So some of the sort of risk areas. But what I want to start with is kind of main thrust of today, which is around documents that have too much legalese in them and they're just a bit bland, a little bit boring, quite long and quite technical, and whether that is actually right, for all of your employees that you have. Now, there is a stylistic choice here. And I think, Adrienne, like you've already said, there's maybe from differing parts of the spectrum in terms of how far we can push the envelope in what a contract actually looks like, right? I mean, we had this discussion yesterday about it.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some funky ones, haven't we? We've seen some really funky ones with
Super funky ones.
some of them are in pictures, some of them are almost like in a presentation, which is interactive. I mean, people have gone mad in terms of the design and the creativity, which may well match the voice of your organisation, which is fantastic. I mean, certainly as lawyers, when we come to advise on something, the first thing we ask for is a copy of the contract. If we get something like that and it does the job, then fantastic. And that's why I think it's important to think about what impression you're trying to get, particularly when you're talking about hiring. Sorry, I've probably completely
Yeah, no,
lost
not
my
at all. I
train
mean,
of thinking.
I think those contracts are a few and far between, right? I mean, I love it when there's something a little bit different, or when a client asks us to help them with something that's a little bit different, because I think there's just kind of untapped opportunity there, in terms of really selling your brand and selling your values and producing something that's really consistent with what you're saying to prospective employees through the recruitment process as well. So I think, we know businesses, we've seen businesses that put so much effort into brand and culture, but then come up with a really vanilla employment contract that cuts across that and kind of might undermine a little bit the nature of the relationship the prospective employee thinks that they're actually getting into, because it jars a little bit with the rest of their hiring experience. Now, let's talk about plain English documents to start off with. It isn't too difficult to translate contracts into just plain English and take all the legalese out. And we've done that quite a few times for different businesses who want to make their documents just a bit more human, read a bit less like a legal treatise, and just something that's a lot more digestible and easy to understand. And I think tone of voice also is an important component of that. But why would you want to consider completely changing the language of your employment contract and the presentation of your employment contract? And I think there are a few benefits around taking this different approach. So first off, it's seeing and understanding the critical information. So, what's the rate of pay? What are the hours of work? What are the days worked or the shift pattern? What's holiday entitlement? So all the kind of key stuff that can be really, really important to employees, and the stuff that they might want to go back and revisit and just double check on. So is that really accessible? Can it be seen? Is it very easy to understand? Secondly, just appreciating the relevance of the important points as well. So, if there's nothing to distinguish provisions around, say, confidential information, if that's really important for your organization, why is it buried on page 12 of a 20-page employment contract in the same font and under, the same type of heading as all the other information? What can you do to make that more visually attractive, put shining lights around it, and really flag that it's something that's important? The third point is around accessibility of information as well. And this might be particularly so if you've got employees that are perhaps not used to looking at 15, 20-page long, closely typed text of documents. You might have employees that have English as a second language,
Neurodiverse.
neurodiverse employees that, want to be able to access information in a different way. So it has that advantage as well. In terms of some of the practical approaches that we've seen working well here, obviously I've mentioned plain English documents. So a really easy starting point is just get a document and strip out the legalese and just say in plain English what it is you're trying to achieve. A second approach we've done as well is also just having almost like a one-page table as a front or second sheet of the document with all of the critical information. And that kind of serves two purposes, really. I think the first is you know where to find it, you know where to find it quickly. So you're not leafing through a document and going clause by clause to find out the information and piecing it all together. It's there, all together, all self-contained. I think from an admin perspective as well, if you're drafting these documents, it's a heck of a lot easier to only have to change the variable provisions that appear on one page rather than having to go into clause two, clause four, clause five, clause 15, clause 12, and remembering where those points are that need to be changed each time. Because we've seen it loads of times, haven't we, Adrienne? Documents where, and I was looking at a settlement agreement. I know it's not an employment contract, but it's a type of contract used in employment situations this morning. And it's been sent to our client with loads of square brackets in it. There's loads of variable provisions that are still in there, and it's an editing error, like someone's just missed it.
But also you see sort of incongruences as well, don't you? Again, we tend to see this on settlement agreements where we go, right, can we see your contract? And in that contract it says you've got X period, X weeks of notice, and then the employee comes back and goes, actually my offer letter says this. So if you've got an offer letter saying one thing and then you kind of, you've got to wade through a big contract to try and match it up, very often having this table at the front and setting it out makes it an awful lot easier from an admin point of view to ensure that consistency. So it's just kind of, you can use it to help eliminate those types of errors.
Yeah, so that so the sort of easy quick wins are plain English, having the setup of the document to make your life easier and to make that information front and center by front loading that information. If you want to push things a bit further, how visually attractive is your contract? And again, that feeds into the accessibility of the information and the branding and the tone of voice point. So, if you're a tech company, for example, you've got a particular approach, which might be we're light touch in terms of regulatory contractual requirements. We're very informal in terms of our tone of voice. We want it to be first person. You're not really going to want an employment contract that's written with this dense legalese because it just completely jars with that approach. So can you come up with something which, is a lot more visually attractive and which is branded in terms of how your company is branded as well and totally matches your tone of voice? Other approaches we've seen, I quite like the PDF employment contract. So something that is sent electronically, people can skip through. I mean, it doesn't affect the legal enforceability of it, right, as a document,
No,
does it?
exactly. No, exactly. So, sending it out to for people to sign is much easier, I think, now, because then, it's also easier to chase up, right? Because you don't have to look and on a sort of a file somewhere, or did we ever get a signed version? And of course, all this stuff comes into relevance at the point where it all goes wrong. So this is making sure that you're, before you're getting married, you're preparing for divorce type of stuff, as I always call it. It's like, it's like your prenup. So there's a lot of ways where things can be made an awful lot easier for sure.
Using something like DocuSign or an equivalent, in terms of having that audited approach, I mean, it works really well in training records. It works really well for employment contracts to be able to show that, yeah, we did actually get the employee's written agreement to this. And like you say, if we're into a dispute at the end of the employment relationship, all that's a lot easier. But having a really funky contract that is different to the norm is not going to undermine really the legal enforceability of that document. And you can also take it to an approach anyway. You could present something like in a PDF format or some other type of graphic that's emailed out. It doesn't stop you being able to strip out the key information and putting it into a plain text document and holding that on file as
No,
well. So
exactly.
you can take that approach. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could say, look, here's a shiny example of a contract that we've done that ticks all of the boxes that we're talking about. I don't have one that I can share on this call, at least because it's got client information in there. I don't think they'd be too happy about divulging that. The closest thing I've got actually is just some of the legally and graphically designed information we've put on our website. So I think, Adrienne, you're going to talk about just couple of other good examples in a moment. And whilst you're doing that, I'll put a link up to where people can just see some visual examples of some of the process flows that we've got. So that's really indicative of what you could be producing for your company. Before I do that, then, the second point I wanted to make, so aside from too much legalese, bland, boring documents, second key point are contracts not being tailored enough to protect your business interests. And the first example of that is just having no business protection provisions whatsoever. So what I'm talking about there are things like not having adequate confidentiality provisions. So most businesses will have some form of confidential information, be it pricing lists, the recipe for the secret sauce that they don't want competitors and outside parties finding out about. So if you've got that nailed down properly, intellectual property rights as well. So particularly where you're in a creative industry, perhaps you've got employees that are actually creating stuff for you. They might be writing code, they might be designing processes and procedures. Have you got those things nailed down properly? Because we see gaps. And thirdly, it's the whole issue around post-termination restrictions. So not only non-compete provisions, and I know it's a bit controversial, I think, around whether or not you should be stopping people going to compete, and the law is in a bit of a state of flux around that potentially. But also, are you adequately protecting the stability of your workforce? So are the restrictions in terms of former employees being able to go and then hire your own employees when they move, so losing out on team moves and things like that. That's also a risk as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's, this is coming back and probably more into the traditional sort of advice when we're talking about post-termination restrictions. But it goes without saying, and I think we probably covered this before, that it's, the question is it right to restrict a very junior employee in the same way as someone in your C-suite, for example? And this is something we see time and again, where we see contracts. And again, we tend to see them more when everything goes wrong and we're talking about exits. Is it right that they have the same thing? It's what's the assessment of the business risk? Now, if you are serious about being able to enforce, and I'm not necessarily talking about non-compete because we know those are more difficult to enforce, but the non-poaching of staff, the non-contacting of your customer base, for example, you've got to have a serious think about what roles, who might be appropriate to restrict, and what it is you are actually trying to protect. So where's the risk? And I sometimes feel like I bang my head against a brick wall, but it's no good coming up later and going, we want to enforce these restrictions if we haven't done the pre-work. So the pre-work can be really onerous, but working on the business reasons as to why you need the protection at the time the contracted is entered into is what's actually needed. So you might say, okay, so we've got some really junior staff, we don't need to restrict them. But if those are the junior staff that have the face-to-face contact with your customers, then you probably do need to have protection against them going out to work with those customers. But you need to document that thought process and then reflect that as the reality in the contract. So you might be sitting there saying, oh, well, look, we never enforce these things and we're never going to go to court anyway. And that's absolutely fine because it's flipping expensive, it's risky, etc. But don't forget that one of the most important reasons to have these restrictions in your contract is not so that you can go running off to the High Court to get an injunction. It's to act as a proper deterrent to make sure that your employees take one look at their contract and go, hang on a minute, I've got to think about this. Or then your employer might say, have you got any restrictions in your contract? And if they're well drafted, then it does put the brakes on a little bit and lets people think about it. So do consider it carefully, even if you think, oh, it's fine, I'm never going to go to court anyway.
Just on that point, actually, where you're saying employees, reading their employment contract and thinking, ah, it's making me pause. Actually, the amount of conversations I've had with individuals who are unaware that
Don't
there are
know.
post-termination restrictions. I mean, it comes up quite a bit for revising, say, senior execs on settlement agreements, and they might have an awareness that they're restricted in some way, but I'm astounded by the number of times that they're not across the detail in terms of exactly how they're restricted. Well, another way of addressing that from the employer side is that presentation of information. So where are your post-termination restrictions concerned? Are they sufficiently clear and well explained?
But
Because
also, if they're end at the
yeah.
end of the document, the employee's probably got like word fatigue by the time they get there.
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
I totally agree with you. I've got friends that have never read their contracts. They didn't read, they, you know, they've blindly entered into a contract with a 1 month notice period when they're super, super senior, and 12 months of restrictions across just about everything, and they've not bothered, because what they've done is they've looked at their pay, their hours of work, place of work, and not read on. So if that's something, you know, if that's something that you're happy with, then that's absolutely fine. But my view is, if it's something that you really want to stress it about, move it up to the front. Have the table of the main terms, and then the first bit of text can be all about business protection, because there's no reason why, other than historic reasons, that it tends to fall sort of down towards page 20.
What about the kind of disconnect between what a contract says and what's actually happening on the ground?
Yeah, you've got to make sure the contract reflects reality. Now, this has come into sharp focus post-pandemic, and I do wonder, saying that, whether we are ever going to stop talking about COVID. But there we go. But the classic one is the changes to place of work over time. So, you know, you might have a contract which says, you know, your place of work is in the office, but in actual fact, you've moved to hybrid, or you've moved to entirely remote home working. That's when it's worth looking at what is actually in the contract, and have you validly recorded it? Place of work, it really has loads of consequences. Anything from tax treatment. So, will the employee say, "Oh, I can claim travel into the office if you call me in for a meeting as a business expense," in which case, is it taxable or not? But also, frankly, on how you manage performance and conduct. Because if you validly have a contract which says your place of work is in the office, or your place of work is partly in the office, partly at home, and we can call you in at any time, then if you say to an employee, "You're not performing properly, we'd like you to step into the office so you can sit with a mentor or have that support," then you can point to the contract and go, "We actually have the right to do this." So, you know, those are just a couple of examples of why it's
Yeah, I
important
mean
that your
redundancy
contract.
implications as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
Where this
yeah,
work is.
yeah. So, yeah, it must reflect reality. It's not just a document to fill in and shove in a drawer.
No, absolutely not. Before I go on to the next couple of points, just deal with a couple of questions we've had in. So, does the size of an organization make a difference to the type of contract and how it looks? No, not necessarily. I mean, I think the contract needs to be tailored to your organization. But I've seen a few examples of large corporates. I mean, I'm talking businesses that probably employ 25, 30,000 people that have taken a pared back approach when it comes to both settlement agreements. I mean, I can think of, I've seen settlement agreements from Vodafone, Tesco, Microsoft, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone's on the call from those organizations or has worked in those organizations previously, but I've seen examples of both contracts, policy documents, and settlement agreements from a mix of those organizations that have been pared back,
Readable. Readable.
readable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the temptation is you get lawyers involved, or somebody who's been burnt by a particular experience that says, hey, do you know what? We need to account for this really novel scenario now within our contracts, and you go from a fairly workable document to something that's just morphed into something. So to come back to the question, I don't think the size of an organization makes a particular difference. I think it's the type of organization you are as to what provisions you want to have in there, really, is the way that I would look at that.
Yeah, it's what you need. That's the important bit. Yeah.
Someone else has asked, how many contracts should there be? We seem to have at least five different contracts for different professions within the business. Yeah, that's a good question.
Oh, we get that all the time, as everyone's, it drives everybody bonkers that everyone has to manage so many different iterations of contracts. And I totally get it. Now, I mean, I think you can have, well, it depends on your workforce, right? But certainly some of the clients I've worked with have got things like, here's a full-time contract, or here's a full-time permanent contract, and then we've got a full-time fixed-term contract, for example. That would be where you would need differences. But, you know, there you're going to have you've got to have variations within it, and typically you're going to see variations around things like, you know, apart from salary, place of work, etc. You're going to see variations on things like notice periods and what I was just talking about in terms of post-termination restrictions. It's a question of whether or not you have one document with like a note going, this needs to be varied according to the level. But some people just prefer to say, if it's this level above, we'll use that contract. If it's that level, we use this one. And if it's this one, we use another one. It's an ongoing nightmare, I think, for HR in terms of keeping track of that admin. But just remember, the more contracts that you have, the more you have to keep updated.
And there's no harm in having like a core-based document, is there, and then
No,
bolt-ons. I mean, certainly when it comes to things
exactly.
like post-termination restrictions, you can have a bolt-on document as long as
Yeah.
it's expressed in the right way.
Yeah.
I'll have contractual status as well to help
Exactly.
manage that.
Yeah.
Let's take one other question before we move on. Are the courts still taking a dim view of restrictive covenants? I mean, the fundamental approach hasn't changed, so far as I'm aware, which is courts will see a non-compete clause as as being against public policy, which is why they're only going to be enforceable in really narrowly defined circumstances. But there are plenty of examples where they have been enforceable. We've litigated on them and had them enforced, so we know from lived experience, how it all operates. I think the wider mood change is there's just been murmurings around reform in this area. So basically, government intervention and whether there'll be basically, I think Labour's view, I think I've got this right, but I think Labour's view is that non-compete provisions amount to a barrier to growth because they
Yeah.
dissuade people from leaving a business and being entrepreneurial and setting up potentially in competition. So people are just sitting in their existing company and being unproductive. Now, I know like a lot of you on the call will probably have a certain view about that. But that's the line that's been pushed. If you look at what's happening across the pond in America, I'm a bit sketchy on the detail, but I think I don't know if it's at a federal level or not, but there are non-compete provisions now which have been banned. So in certain circumstances, they're not enforceable. It's unlawful to have a non-compete provision within an employment contract. I think there are some exceptions in terms of base
Yeah,
salary and level of role.
I think
Sorry,
so.
Jen.
But I mean, certainly there was a consultation under the previous government about the non-competes itself, and that was whether or not if you wanted to enforce it, you had to pay, because that's very much like in some European entities, including Switzerland as well. But remember, that's the non-compete. There's nothing to stop you prevent from going for non-solicitation of customers, if you can generate it. But I think the law hasn't massively changed around this, nor has the court's approach, which is okay. You come to us and you tell us you want to enforce. Force it, prove it to us why you need it. Prove it to us why your confidential information provisions don't already do the job that you're asking for. What is it that you need that is extra that you want us to stop this person from doing X, Y, and Z? That's realistically what it's always been about. And I think it's how it continues to be about. But the non-compete itself, like you can't go and work for a competitor, is always the trickiest to enforce because potentially you're stopping somebody from earning a living. The courts don't like that.
No, it's a starting point. Okay, some of the other things we've seen not working well, too long a contract, basically. So I'm talking here about a contract which contains all the information you could ever dream of in relation to employing somebody. It's unmanageable, potentially creates a bunch of additional legal risk for you because if you've got things that should properly go into a policy or a handbook document, you've included it in the employment contract. The danger is you're giving it contractual status. And then when you want to depart from that policy or process in the future, you're actually acting in breach of contract. And that can have knock-on consequences for things like enforceability of post-termination restrictions. So really, it's about getting the balance right. There's no one size fits all answer to it. I mean, tied to the question we've had about what sort of size contract do we need on the size of the organization? It depends, but it requires some thought and application in terms of the commercial context within which you're actually operating. But yeah, I see that quite a bit. Contracts that have everything in the kitchen sink thrown into them, and they just become this unworkable thing. So you've got to get that balance right.
There's always the practical point, isn't there, about when you introduce it, because everyone might be thinking, "Well, God, we really need to change our contracts." Well, changing them is great. Getting people to sign up to them who are your existing staff is a different matter. So, a couple of things on that just to think about is one, try and peg it to some kind of increased benefit. Typically, you would see that as a pay increase. So if you're doing it around pay review time, then that's a good idea. Hey, we'll give you this pay review. but by the time you know, because of changes, we've reviewed our contracts and we wanted to sign this new contract, and then that ticks the box regarding consideration. Another thing I always think is a really good trigger is if you're promoting somebody. So if you're promoting somebody into a new role, and I am banging on about restrictions again, that gives you the opportunity to think, right, they're going higher up the chain. Do we need to think about what business protection we need now that they're moving into that new role? So that would be a good example to say, congratulations, here's your new role, here's your new contract. And certainly in that situation, you're much less likely to get pushback from signing because people want to be promoted, right? So, you know, that's okay.
What about probationary periods? So I know we've had a question on that as
well. Yeah, so probationary periods, the jury's still out on this, isn't it? We're waiting on tenterhooks. And of course, that may well be your trigger when you do start the review of your contracts, because obviously, you know, with the proposed change to the qualifying service for unfair dismissal, we know that probationary periods are going to come into sharp focus. We don't know anything more yet. So, you know, we will obviously keep you posted when we do, but that would certainly be at a point where you go, right, let's have a really careful look at the contracts.
Yeah, I mean, we did a dedicated episode actually on change in this area, because for those of you that don't know, Labour are talking about bringing day one unfair dismissal rights, not 2 year unfair dismissal rights. So day one, probation periods are likely to be a very key component of that and how you use them. If you just want to catch up our thoughts on that, there's an episode from July. I can't remember the exact date, around the 20th or so, I think, of July. We did a half hour run through of what we're aware of at the moment. So you can find that on our website and on Spotify and Amazon Music as well. Before we wrap up, let me just get to a couple of other questions. So is it advisable to issue a contract amendment to all staff where we've moved to hybrid, but this isn't yet amended in the contract template?
Yes.
Yeah.
Comes back to what we were saying about making sure your contract reflects reality. So yes, if you have moved to that model, then yes, a simple letter will be fine. And then obviously for any new hires, you can put that in the contract. But I would try and retain an element of flexibility around the hybrid policy if you can. And I think that probably leads us into the next question, doesn't it? Contract said work from office, but policy is hybrid. Are you advising that hybrid working is placed in the contract and can it stay in policy only? So I think that's a similar answer to the question that we've had before. You need to think contractually, where is the place of work? What am I telling the employee where they want to work? Is it a case of, you know, your role is hybrid, and then you can refer to a hybrid policy. And then in that policy, you might have wording like, you know, the current arrangement is 2 days in the office, 3 days at home, but we reserve the right to bring you in. Actually, reserve the right is probably the legalese that you're talking about not using. But we may bring you in if we need to, for example, for performance management reasons, meetings, etc. That's realistically what a lot of people are doing. Sorry, I'm losing my voice.
Yeah, well, I think it's the fundamental question there is, do you want that hybrid working as a policy and something that you retain the right to be able to chop and change over time? Or do you acknowledge that it's a contractual entitlement that is permanently part of someone's T's and C's unless you agree with them to change that?
Otherwise.
So that's a starting point.
Yeah.
Another question is, I have seen clauses in contracts which say does not form part of your contract, often relating to policies. Can you elaborate on the meaning behind this? Yeah, I mean, that is to try and avoid confusion about whether something that's contained in an expressed employment contract is actually contractual itself.
One might be a disciplinary.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we discipline you, please refer to the disciplinary. So that wording basically wants to flag that there is an existence of that policy and that it will be used, but it doesn't form part of your contract in that, you know, if you as the employer don't follow it to the absolute 100% letter of the law, you can't be done for breach of contract.
Yeah, absolutely. A thought popped in my head then, but rapidly popped out as you were talking.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's, I mean, it was just related to making that point around what is the true status of it. Oh, yeah, that's it. I mean, the risk, Maria, who asked the question, of not stating that wording is that if the contract's silent on it and doesn't say this doesn't form part of your contract, the risk there is that through the silence, it actually does form contractual provision. So that's why it will expressly state does not form part of your contract. And then one other question is just views on probationary periods and whether it will be limited to X number of months. Yeah, I think that, I mean, The best thing for me to do is just direct you to that episode that we've done next. I think we talked probably 35 minutes about probation periods and how we see it all dovetailing and the practical things you can start thinking about now, actually start planning for the change that's coming. Because there's going to be heck of a lot of change over the next 12 to 24 months, and probation periods are definitely going to be part of that. In the chat, by the way, if you haven't seen, I've just put a link to that section on our website where you can see some of the graphically designed documents that I've been alluding to. Is there another question? I just saw someone's raised their hand, but I'm not able to open your mic up or anything. So if you're quick, stick a question in the Q&A box and I'll have a look. Otherwise, in terms of takeaways from today, I think when you're looking at your next refresh of your employment contracts, just have a look with a fresh pair of eyes and really ask yourself these three key questions when you're going through that process. Number one, does this document reflect our company's tone of voice and brand? So is it on point with that? Secondly, is it accessible to the employee in both style and content? So, are there adequate explanations about what those provisions are? And are they laid out in an accessible way as well? And number three, does it adequately protect the business? So you've got to identify what particular business risks are and ask yourself, does this document do a good enough job of adequately presenting those risk areas, protecting those risk areas for us? If the answer to any of those questions is no, and you want some help from us, then get in touch, please. In the meantime, we're back in 2 weeks' time, same time. So 11 a.m., 2 weeks today on the Thursday, that's the 26th of September. What we're going to be looking at in that session is just a case roundup. So we want to have a look at the NEXT and the ASDA equal pay claims, because there's been a lot in the media over the last few weeks about equal pay claims. Historically, we've looked at them in the context of public sector disputes and public sector organisations, think Birmingham City Council. Now we're seeing claims and group claims being brought against private companies and PLCs in the private sector. So we want to look specifically at those cases and what considerations there are for non-public sector businesses. So if you've got an interest in that, please join us in 2 weeks' time. That session, by the way, is from viewer feedback. So thanks to the person who suggested that as a topic. If you're sat there thinking, hey, I've got this burning issue, I'd really like you to do a session on it, just send us a message on LinkedIn, send us an email, find details on our website, NPM Legal, and we're very much receptive to new suggestions for topics. But otherwise, enjoy the rest of your week and we'll see you in a couple of weeks' time. So thanks very much.